Our guest today is Gordon Gravett, who has written multi-part series on scenery, specifically trees, plants, foliage, as well as building some fantastic layouts. Thank you very much, Gordon, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
We're going to kick things off with a pretty normal question. How did you get into modelling?
When I was at school, it was not unusual for half the lads in a class to be train spotting and having train sets. It was quite usual toys to have. So, like everybody else, I just mucked in. We had the train sets. I had a Triang. Other people had Hornby. And it went from there. The Triangs weren't that clever, but we could see their shortcomings after a little while. So it gave us the attempts to sort of super detail, if you like, add little bits and pieces, cut bits off, alter things. And gradually I sort of learnt through doing that.
Do you think that starting with quite a crude prototype and adding detail yourself gave you a taste of the bug for scratch building and modelling later on?
Well, it must have helped. I think the great thing was it gave us a lot of practice. You know, it was like an apprenticeship into modelling in a way, forced upon us because some of the stuff was very crude. And I almost count that as an advantage. Look at today's stuff that you can buy. And there's not really, for somebody that just wants to buy and have that particular locomotive or carriage or whatever, there's no great incentive to alter it that much.
I agree. When you were learning to model, and as you've developed, were there any modellers that were an inspiration for you?
Not until I started taking magazines, probably. Railway Modeller, Model Railway Constructor, Model Railway News as well at that time. And there were certain modellers who, I didn't know, they were just names. But people like P.D. Hancock's narrow gauge layouts were always an inspiration because of the scenic effects and the natural atmosphere of them. Peter Denny was another one. The flow of the track work, the fact that everything on his layouts had to be scratch built because of the time period when he built them and to EM gauge. You know, you couldn't help but admire that sort of modelling. And although you couldn't imagine getting anywhere near to it ever, it was an inspiration, certainly. Later on, I joined a model railway club when I was old enough to. I think I'd be 13 or 14 years old. And then straight away, then I was really inspired by other people in the club. One guy in particular was very good on the scenic side, and I learnt a lot and have done over the years. I'll give him a name check, Brian Champion. He's always inspired me in, you know, scenic work. Early days were in 4mm scale, and that after joining the Crawley Model Railway Club, I was influenced into sort of working in EM scale. Then I had a complete break from it all, started back in about 15 years later and decided to try 7mm, but 7mm narrow gauge. The 016.5 7mm narrow gauge running on 16.5mm track. And I built some Tallaghlin stock, which I've always liked the Tallaghlin railway, a lot of atmosphere. There were some kits available, so I bought kits and built those. And built up a little railway, small, narrow gauge, little layout based on the Tallaghlin stock. It was totally fictitious. After that, I built an proper O-gauge layout. I got sort of inspired to build some O-gauge stock. I wanted to build a couple of engines that I knew from my days in Sussex. So they were sort of probably the starting point for that, which led me into a bit of scratch building, which I hadn't tried before. That was good fun. And a small O-gauge layout, again, very fictitious, terribly contrived and unrealistic in a way, but that was Ditchling Green. Then I was starting to look towards something a little bit different altogether.
So this is Penpool?
That was Penpool,
yeah.
Yes.
So this is the 150 scale metre gauge French layout that you made?
Yes.
Okay. What was the inspiration behind that?
It all started with a holiday. My wife Maggie is very much a Francophile. She's been going to France since she was a teenager. Once we got together, then I went on many a holiday with her. And there was always that, you see a difference in the landscape, a difference in the towns to Britain. And as somebody who enjoys modelling, I always wanted to try and create that. It was a challenge to try and create that little bit of difference. You know, what was it that was so different? I was at the time looking to start a new project altogether, and ideas started forming about this French meter gauge layout. I think the French theme started when I attended a slideshow at a local club in Weston-super-Mare, and one of the guys showed this presentation of the Raisoz-Breton Railway. Slides taken from the sort of late 50s right through to mid-60s, I think. And at the time, I was looking for something fresh to build a model of.
Very different. I mean, the scale that you're working in is not one that's commercially produced.
No, well, this was something... When I started, I was very aware of the fact that there was nothing I could buy. We did a couple of reconnaissance trips. Fortunately, Maggie's got the language, so she was able to chat to people, and we had a look around, and we found various bits and pieces. There are locos, or a loco. We found a couple of wagons rotting away. From the initial thoughts of something loosely based on this Raisoz-Breton, we realised there was a chance of building something a little bit more accurate. There was enough information out there. There were buildings that we could measure. And again, through Maggie's language, we even managed to get to see, or got offered the opportunity to copy, a whole load of drawings of buildings and structures on the railway. They just threw the collection open to us. It was amazing, the hospitality we had.
Had anyone asked them for this before?
I don't think so. No, this was just all drawings that were just stored in a floor-to-ceiling cupboard. And when Maggie explained what we were trying to do, and we were looking for any sort of information that might be available, this guy just opened this cupboard up and said, "Is this any help?" And he pulled a couple of drawings out and unrolled them. Mostly station buildings, all sorts of structural things that were very useful. Track plans, signalling diagrams, although there wasn't actually much signalling on the Raisoz-Breton itself. There was even drawings of ash pits for a locomotive and all the drainage system for an ash pit, which is something I'd never even considered, that if you've got a pit in the ground, it's going to fill up with water, so it has to be drained. So we had, drawings that we couldn't have imagined before.
Was there something about the bucolic nature of Raisoz-Breton that really appealed to you from a scenery point of view?
Yes, yes. Brittany is a county that, or a department in France that we just really enjoy. Living where we do in the West Country, the channel crossing is fairly easy from Plymouth to Roscoff, and then you're straight into Brittany. Within an hour's drive, you're down really in the centre of the Raisoz-Breton network, as it was, because this all closed down in 1967. Whereas we were starting to go over there in the early 90s, it had already been closed, best part of 25 years. But there was still a lot to see. You could follow the track beds, mostly turned into cycle paths, walkways. So you could see the sort of nature of the landscape it was running through. And yes, it did. We just thoroughly enjoyed it. And that became the challenge, I think, to try and replicate this, or a flavour of it. We hadn't the space to build anything the full size. I know there are advocates of always building something, a true model of a true station. But there was no chance of that. And the French have got so much space, or certainly in Brittany, they don't have very confined station areas. They tend to spread way out, way beyond the space I might have available. So everything would have to be sort of truncated and shortened. So we took a fictitious scenario, took certain structures, street scenes, ordinary domestic buildings. The station building was built to scale as a standard design anyway. So all the actual railway equipment was built to scale. But the setting was totally fictitious, and we just borrowed various buildings and structures from around to compose a scene.
And how did you deal with the selective compression? What did you choose to squeeze together and what to leave as a wide open space?
One of the things about Brittany in particular is this spaciousness. And if I started squeezing tracks together too much, it would start looking... If, for instance, you take a British railway, you've got double track spacing. On a French metre gauge, or certainly on the Raisoz-Breton, the spacing of the tracks at the stations is much wider. It just feels that much. So it was a case of how much do you squeeze it up, or at what point do you start leaving tracks out of a typical station arrangement? So we did that. Then we also had to compress the length. The stations, in reality, would be... Well, they were capable of taking very long trains. We hadn't got the capacity, even in the fiddlyard of the layout, to take the long trains. So there was no point. We were running short trains anyway, so we could afford to compress the length of the stations a little bit. And I suppose that led me to realise that working in the scale of 1 to 50, which I'd chosen really because everything was measured in metric. By now I'd got drawings, I'd measured locomotives and wagons, but they were easy to measure in metric dimensions. And dividing by 50 was going to be so much easier than sort of converting it all to a typical British modelling scale, i.e. 7 millimetres to the foot. So if we started converting our metric dimensions into feet and then dividing those by 7 millimetres, and then it was just going to get too complex. So it just seemed 1 to 50, which also happened to work out around about 6 millimetres to the foot. And, I mean, to add to the story a little bit, I'd already seen some models of some Irish railways built at 6 millimetres to the foot, which was logical. It was very easy to scale at that. And a 3-foot gauge railway at 6 millimetres to the foot runs on 18 millimetre track, EM. So my thoughts were, well, if he can get away with it on the Irish, I'm sure I can get away with it on the Brezzo-Breton. And whereas I had accepted I was going to have to build everything from scratch, when it comes to locomotives in particular, a little help wasn't going to go amiss. And to be able to get axles, wheels, chassis components, to build basically EM chassis was going to be a lot easier than sort of reinventing track gauges and wheel standards. So I adopted EM wheel standards, track gauges. The fact that it should be 20 millimetres, I thought, well, as I'm compressing everything in length and slightly in width over the whole scene, to narrow the track down by what is in effect 1.8 millimetres wasn't going to show that much. So I was happy to have that as a compromise.
It's still an amazing feat, not something I would jump into with both feet. One of the things I want to talk about today is considering railways in context as part of the scenery. This is very important for you.
It is, yes. I don't see a railway in isolation at all. In fact, it's the scenery, the scene in general, which starts the whole thing rolling for me. It's got to look right within a context, within a scene.
This is helping towards the willing suspension of disbelief for the viewer.
Yes, it is. If I go back sort of to when I was sort of, you know, detailing the whole, the triangles and things, then it was just the trains. But I think as, you know, when I got more inspired by the scenic work and see how trains fit into a landscape, it's that that sort of starts the whole thing going. And now if I want to sort of start thinking about doing a model of anything, it's the whole visual impression of the scene that has more bearing. Yes, the railway is obviously important. It's got to fit in there as well, but it's got to be within that scenic setting.
Regarding the scenic setting in terms of geography, Tony Wright said that you should be able to remove all of the stock, all of the trains, and still be able to tell where the layout is set. Is that something you agree with?
Yes, I think so. I know you can take a totally rural scene and you probably would have very few clues as to where it was. But generally speaking, you've certainly got an ambience of a part of the country, maybe, even if not a specific area. And sometimes, you know, obviously in sort of venturing over to sort of modelling French railways, there was a complete different countryside to think about there. So in that case, you know, very much it was creating the atmosphere of the French landscape.
Are there any golden rules that you think the modellers should try and stick to try and make the railway appear as part of a scene?
I think the only one I can really sort of come up with initially, I suppose, is to think of the whole scene before you jump too deep into the actual track laying model railway side of it. Try and compose a scene that's going to be aesthetically pleasing. That's the way I work. I tend to start with a sketch pad and just do loads of doodles of what I think the whole picture is going to look like, rather than start with a track plan. We have to start with track plans. I'm not saying don't, because usually we're very constrained with what fits where, and we need to know we're going to get the right number of carriages in the platform, the right number of wagons in the yard. It's all got to fit in the fiddle yards. We've got to be able to have loco releases that are going to be the right length. So the track plan and the clearances are all very important early on. But before I go into too much detail on the track plan, having established the fact that it will work, I then start the doodling and the sort of just trying to create this picture. I don't get involved with things like Templot. If you're building an accurate model of something, I'm sure that's very beneficial. But my methods tend to be more a roll of wallpaper on the floor and a pencil and just some wagons or something to push around and see if I've got the clearances.
Do you find that picturing something in 3D space is much more useful than seeing it on a diagram?
Yes, yes. Even just little cardboard cutouts for buildings, mock-ups made out of cereal boxes, all sorts of little things just to see it, as you say, in 3D, helps to sort of put it into a context. Yes, there's still contours, there's still banks and embankments and things to sort of think about, maybe later on, differences in height of the landscape. But just to sort of get the basic shape of where the buildings are going to go and how they're going to relate helps to start, and then the rest of it. But I'd say the number of sort of sketches and doodles that go through, I get through pads of paper before I get anywhere that I'm really happy with.
And how do you think the modellers should make use of height or differences in height within the layout to compose a scene?
It helps a lot. It depends on what you're trying to replicate. If you're modelling something sort of in Suffolk or Norfolk, then probably you want a fairly flat landscape, as is Brittany. It's a fairly flat landscape. I couldn't afford any sort of deep cuttings or high embankments. There were the odd ones on the railway system over there, but they weren't typical, and I really wanted to sort of replicate this sort of flattish landscape. It's a case really of sort of working that to the area of the country that you're trying to replicate in model form.
What methods do you think are good for achieving a sense of depth within a layout? Because a lot of them are limited to, you know, a few feet in width.
Oh, yes. Mine in particular are. I've never built anything wider than 2 foot, usually a few inches narrower, simply from the handling point of view. I mean, my situation at home is I have to sort of move these things around the house, up the stairs and all sorts of things. So, yeah, it's always difficult to get enough width into a layout. The only way I can really suggest doing it, and I've done it on the last 2 layouts I've built, is to add a back scene and try and extend that scene into the back scene.
And what's a good method for creating depth within a back scene? Because there are lots of different types of back scene, some more effective than others, but what do you think would make an effective back scene, given that depth?
Try and sort of picture what would be seen, and I work my own. I do paint up my own back scenes. You can get a lot of good, very good photographic back scenes available now. It's getting the colours to balance with the layout and get a convincing transition from one to the other. What we found with the Penpaul one was just sort of basic rolling hills, but just fading the colours right out. It's a case of starting with the foreground colours almost the same as the layout colouring, and then running it right out and keeping the horizon. In the case of a flat layout, or where you want to see what I might call a big sky, so you've got, again, something like Norfolk, Suffolk areas, to try and create that impression by keeping the horizon low and having a lot of sky involved. I always prefer to have a full height back scene now. It's not always been the case. My earlier layouts all had just little 6-inch bit of plywood along the back, which worked in so much that it helped to sort of pack the layout up compactly in storage. But then I, and at that time, we were operating layouts from the rear. Now I've tended to change my thoughts on that and prefer to operate from the front, which gives me, when we're exhibiting a layout, a chance to talk to the public generally. And it's about all modelling things. The subjects vary so much. But it's nice to be able to just chat to people. And it's very much a two-way thing because you learn a lot yourself. You're talking to the public, although you're displaying your own layout, you're learning a heck of a lot from other people as well. But by operating from the front, then I can afford to have the back scene at a full height and make it all part of the display, part of the picture. I suppose what I'm trying to do is create a picture. And
in terms of viewing a layout, do you design one with a specific viewing position in mind, or do you try and take into account that someone might be standing off to the side or seeing at things from an angle?
There will always be what I consider to be ideal viewing positions, because these are what the pictures in my mind when I start designing the layout. I get a certain viewpoint that I start working from, if you like. Having done that, maybe one or two more might crop up while you're constructing and arranging, you know, where to put a tree. If I put it there, I can look round that. I can just get a view through there. and this sort of situation. We had a similar situation on my current layout, which is Arran Quay, which initially I had a viewpoint in mind, and the whole scene was based around my imagination of walking down a road to a quayside. And I could just picture myself walking down this road. It had to be downhill because we're going down to the quayside. And that the layout was based or built around that scene, which I had in mind. And that scene worked, which I was pleased about. But when we started sort of putting everything out, and again, in mock-up form still, we're talking about sort of cardboard buildings, just, you know, cereal box bits. It needed something in the foreground. The centre foreground looked very boring. And I couldn't think of what to put in there. Trees weren't really an option on that layout because we're very close to a small industrial quayside. You just wouldn't get mature trees in that sort of situation. It occurred to me that maybe a water tank. Now, whether a water tank in reality would have been there, I don't know. But it seemed a plausible thing. And I put this, and I made this thing up, again, just a little cardboard box and stuck it on some drinking straws for legs. And just sort of positioned that on my roller wallpaper and started looking around it. And suddenly, between that and a building the other side of the track, I had another viewpoint altogether. And one which was, to me, was a very pleasing one. So, yeah, that came out sort of as an afterthought, but it was a very pleasing one. Those two work. The layout isn't that big anyway. It's only 7'6" long. So you haven't got to shuffle far along a layout before you can see something, hopefully. Some of the other viewpoints. I don't like to think of anything as being boring on the front, but yeah, those two particularly stick in my mind.
I suppose with exhibition layouts especially, we kind of face the same challenges that people who make studio sitcoms have, where you remove the fourth wall of the layout. So introducing things like visual breaks can help break up a scene.
Yes.
When I left the hobby, sort of moved on to school, and cars and things like that, we were at a stage where scatter and lichen were still very widely used, almost exclusively used, apart from if you were a very fine scale modeler. When I came back to the hobby, there was this new thing called static grass, which I'd never heard of before. But what are the landmark events, do you think, in scenic modeling over the last 20 years or so?
Well, certainly now the static grass is making a lot of difference. I mean, like yourself, I took a break from the hobby. And again, it was scatter materials. It was dyed sawdust very much then, and the lichens. And then when I came back into it, what seemed to be in vogue then was to use medical lint, glued down, fluffy side down, and then rip the back off to get the sort of hairy texture of the lint to represent grass. And then it could be dyed or painted and brushed up. And there were some very, very effective 4mm scale layout, certainly. I mean, Barry Norman was a great exponent of that, and his Petherick was the layout that's most really inspired landscape-wise when I came back into the hobby. It had depth as well. I mean, Barry was very bold. He went something like 4 or 5 foot in depth. His baseboards were sort of the typical 4 foot by 2 foot, but turned around the other way.
Wow.
So the whole layout, it was really, you know, quite a landmark layout from the scenic point of view. And it inspired me no end. I tried to replicate this, but in 7mm scale, but the dyed lint isn't really man enough in that scale. So then we moved on to carpet underlay, the sort of fibrous carpet underlays that you can tear apart. It's used at Pendon for all their grass work there, has been for years. They use it on a 4mm layout. It also works in 7mm, but it's very time-consuming to lay. I did ditchling green with that, and the effects were very reasonable, good, I think, but took a heck of a long time. And then suddenly we were starting to hear about this German sort of invention of static grass. First of all, just using these shake-up puffer bottles to puff the fibres. You agitate them in a plastic bottle, create a bit of static that way by agitation, and then puff them onto some wet glue. They stand up a little bit. And then these grass applicators became available. The early ones weren't that effective, but now they are very, very good.
So this allows you to achieve similar results to before, but in a fraction of the time.
Absolutely. And far more effective, because the carpet underlay never really stood straight. It was always a bit curly. Very difficult to sort of get convincing looking grass. and it was a case of brushing paint through it to get the best effects. If you wanted to sort of show grass with sort of drying out and the sort of more straw colours on the tips, then it all had to be done by painting. Whereas with the static grass, you can build up the height using different colours. Infinite number of ways of doing the grass.
And then are there any other developments that have happened in that period, specifically for scenics, that you think have been a giant leap forward for modelling? Because I would say that your books specifically on trees have enabled lots of people with the methods described to make sort of a quantum leap forward in the quality of their modelling in trees. Whilst it's not an off-the-shelf product, it's definitely a method, I think, that's just effective.
Yes, a product which I've become aware of. It's certainly not new, because I'm sure theatrical outlets have used it for a long time. And that's a product called Postiche, which is an artificial hair. It's been used for dolls, doll manufacturer, and it's in theatrical use a lot. But that's suddenly become available, well, not suddenly, but some years ago, became available through the scenic suppliers. And you could tease this out incredibly fine. It's almost an invisible membrane. And I use a lot of that, and on the trees, as you say, to get the airiness, the see-throughness of a tree, to be able to use this Postiche and then just put a very light scattering. One of the problems with some of the earlier model trees was they were very dense. And probably through the products that we were using the lichens, we were taking lumps of sponge rubber and just tearing it to pieces and painting it green and sticking it on twigs, which didn't look that fantastic, but that was what we had at the time. And then gradually you start to sort of take notice of what real trees start to look like. I mean, that can be a hobby in itself, just studying trees, forming the skeletal shapes of trees with wire, so that it doesn't just look like a tree, it looks like a specific type of tree.
And no two trees are alike.
No, they're not. I mean, you can sort of, you'll never, I don't think anybody will ever build an exact model of a particular tree. You can certainly make an oak tree look quite different to a silver birch, for instance. And again, a beech tree will have its own, you know, the barks, the trunks, the general spread of the trees are all very different. And you can certainly get close to a representative tree.
It's interesting that you say about the semi-opaque, semi-transparent nature of the trees that you model now, because I think that basically changes the way the light interacts with the tree and the way that your eye perceives it. I think that really sets them apart from, like you say, the sort of 2D trees that we had before.
Yes. And the other thing is that, and this is just purely a sort of theory of mine, is that if you build a model tree that you can, it's open enough that you can see through to something the other side of it, it helps to give the layout an impression of depth. Even if there's not a lot of depth there, you can look through, you can have one tree in the foreground, you can look through that and something else. It needn't be a tree, it can be something else, but you can see beyond the tree. The tree isn't a mask.
And that allows your brain to focus on two different objects.
Yes. And it's, otherwise you've got this sort of solid lump in the front, which you can look around, but you can't see through. But once you can start looking through it and you can see something else, and if it's another tree, beyond that maybe, and into the landscape, into the distance. And that can all help to give the eye gets the impression of distance, even if it's not really there.
Even in 2 foot?
Even in a couple of foot, yeah. And varying the colouring. So taking denser colours in the foreground and muting those colours as they go further back into the scene.
So is that to simulate a haze?
Yes. I say just subduing the colours a little bit. Bear in mind that if you're looking at a model railway, you were generally looking, a lot of people could say that, talk about the 2 foot rule. If you can't see it from 2 foot, you know, that's fine. Which I go along with. That just certainly for a working model railway, you know, unless you're going to really get your nose right down to the track, you don't see a lot of detail. But even at 2 foot away, if you're talking about, for instance, a 00 four millimeter scale layout, that's something in the region of 150 foot, and that color density is not so strong as it would be if you were right up against it.
Makes sense. I never even considered that before. And that ties into, well, I'm going to stick on that topic a little bit. So given the step forward that static grass have provided modellers, what would you like to see invented to enable us to make more realistic scenes? Is there any gap in the market that you think could be filled?
I don't know if there is at the moment. Water's always difficult. People do achieve some very good water. It's not easy. And then you've also got the conflict. If you, for instance, got a running river on a model, does the fact that you're modelling something that in reality has got motion, but we're modelling it as static, and then we've got the trains having motion, is that a conflict?
I think that a lot of people make a decision, whether they know it or not, quite early in the process, that it, whether they're modelling a world that moves or whether they're modelling a frozen moment in time that the trains move through.
Yes, we have to make that decision.
Because I think a lot of people will decide whether to use people in motion or people resting. Some people prefer one or the other.
Yes. Oh, no. I would never use people in motion. I say that. I probably have done in the past. But now I look at it as people in sort of passive positions and just resting, as you say. Looks far more convincing. And I've also, over the sort of layouts, started using less and less people. I think a large population starts to make a layout look very overcrowded, in my opinion. And maybe that might be because a lot of the subjects I choose are fairly quiet, subdued subjects. You know, they're quiet country branch lines. They're not busy London termini. So, for instance, Arran Quay, there are only two figures in the open on Arran Quay, and they're both doing nothing, basically.
Is that why the line closed?
No, they're both here for a purpose. There's a chap fishing, and he's just looking over the railing. He's waiting to see if he wants to cast his rod. And there's a shunter waiting in the yard to uncouple some wagons, but he's just standing with his shunter's pole waiting. So he's not sort of in the middle of doing anything, and again the angler isn't in the middle of casting his rod, because I can take all the rolling stock, all the trains off the layout, and I've still got a state scene that works for me, a static scene.
And like you say, water really ties into that, and because we've seen some people animate water before, whether by using real water, which doesn't really scale properly, or by using a visual effect, because I think it was John DeFresne on Cliffhanger did a water effect behind the waterfall to try and give the impression of movement.
That was very clever. Very clever. It was all done through some... I seem to recall it was... whether it was a dry ice or a staged
water
vapour
behind
it. And it certainly was very effective, yes.
I think we're missing is an animation almost for static water or for slow-flowing rivers.
Yes. It's something that's... I don't think real water works. You see it occasionally, and it doesn't, as you say. There's three things that don't scale: water, fire, and smoke.
Yeah, just the things that we actually want to use with steam locomotives. So let's move on a bit. Do you think that there's a danger for people to model models of other models rather than real life?
I think we all get inspiration from other models, and it's a case of where you use it as inspiration, which I don't think is a bad thing. Well, I do. I know I consciously am aware of the fact I see some and think, I really like that. I like the look of that scene. That's something I'd like to sort of copy. You know, I'll steal that one for myself sometime. But I wouldn't want to just copy it, no. And I think it's a case then of using that inspiration but trying to do your own design based around that. But yes, we all get inspired. I'm sure we do. And we've only got to look at the real... You've got to go out into the real landscape and you get inspired in the same way. But I don't think it's always got to be original. I don't like the idea of just saying, you know, I'm going to copy that layout. That layout works really well. I will copy that. It wouldn't suit me anyway. My satisfaction comes from creating a scene.
Yeah, and it shows, I think. How important to you is modelling the mundane then in that case? So rather than giant visual spectacles, the everyday?
I prefer the mundane. I prefer to sort of see the odd sort of broken paving slabs, the weeds, the odd bits of detail in that way, rather than what you might call sort of set scenes, what they might call the cameo scenes. There's so many available commercially, and you tend to see them over and over. I'm sure everybody knows what they are. I needn't go through them, but they don't do a lot for me. Whereas to try and just sort of, you can walk down any street and you can see things that you can pick up and think, oh, I've not seen that model before. You know, just that bit of ivy growing up that wall, or as I say, you know, cracked paving stones.
The odd bit of graffiti here and there.
Yes. It's depends obviously on the periods and what you're modelling. We've got to be careful with periods because, you know, there was a time when things were a lot neater, a lot cleaner than they are now. But certainly 2019, it's, the graffiti is very much part of a lot of scenes, as are the weeds. Mm. You know, we're running through a period now where weeds aren't cleared. Whereas go back 50 years and it was probably, you know, our street scenes were cleaner. The countryside was generally not so much the fields and that, but station platforms, for instance.
Well, when you had more staff, there were more people available to actually tidy up that area. Yes. So that in effect dates the scene as well.
Yes. Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, there aren't very many. I don't see very many modern period layouts with weeds all over through the track and all over the platforms, and yet you see it all the time if you travel on the trains.
When you're gathering inspiration for layouts, you take lots of photographs, but how do you catalogue and refer back to those photos so that you don't lose them again?
I've got numerous files on the computer's obviously the best thing ever since we've been able to take digital photographs. And so I was a bit late into it really, but certainly over the last 15, 20 years, just loads and loads of different files. You know, I've got various miscellaneous files of sort of just about every category you can think of.
So what kind of examples would there be if you were browsing through your files on computer? What kind of browsing through different categories, what kind of categories would you have?
Oh, examples of roofs, of buildings, for instance, slate roofs. I'll photograph those. I'll photograph chimney pots. I'll photograph drain covers. I'll photograph, as I said before, weeds in the gutter. It's bits of broken fencing. I've recently been photographing concrete just to get the colours of concrete, the amount of the lichens that grow on concrete, and the, you know, we think of concrete as being grey, but
every shade in between.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a joke in there somewhere, but I don't think I'm going to say it. No. Here's a nice general one. What do you enjoy most about modelling?
Probably the research. Starting, having chosen a subject, it's looking at how much detail I've got on that particular subject, what's photographs, rummaging through photographs, trying to get as much as I can on it, and then, having done the research, working out how I'm going to make it. That, to me, is a very enjoyable. I enjoy the actual making the model as well. Thoroughly enjoy that. But working out how I'm going to make it, I spend quite a lot of time doing that. Again, lots of doodles, sketches. Is this going to, if I make this first, is that going to fit with that? That side of it, you know, I get a lot of pleasure out of that.
What to you are the so far unachievable things in modelling that you think can be done or accomplished but just haven't been mainstream yet?
Are we still talking about the scenic side of things, or are we talking about the mechanical side?
Well, actually, that's a very good counter question. Let's say modelling as a whole.
Because on the scenic side, I think, you know, with a little bit of ingenuity and thought, we can make a representation of most things, but we can't make things accurate. You know, I'm just looking out here at the moment and I'm seeing a whole bank of nettles. And that's a very tricky thing to model accurately. But that I can't think of what sort of materials you'd have available to you other than a very, very tedious process of making them look as I'm looking at those ones at the moment. So we make the best we can, and with all scenic modelling, I think it's always going to be a representation. We're never going to model everything accurately. We're never going to model every blade of grass. We're never going to model every sort of leaf stem. So we can give an overall impression. That often, I think, it's a little bit of a broad brush solution, but I think it works for a lot of scenic materials. It's a bit different to building a locomotive where you can put in every last rivet, bolt head, tiny little bit wire, clip and everything else. You know, if you've got a mind to, you can do it. Hmm. And it's achievable. As far as sort of the working sides of a model locomotive are concerned, if we can do away with the electrics, that would be wonderful. We can there is already the technology to go with batteries on board, so we haven't got to worry about picking up power through the wheels and through the track.
Would you say that's an Achilles heel of the hobby at the moment?
It's not insurmountable. I mean, we all get round it. We make the best of it we can. We all accept the fact that our track needs cleaning regularly, our wheels need cleaning regularly, and you just have to give something the odd nudge now and again, and that's part of it. But it would be so nice if we didn't have any of that to think of, or any wiring to think about underneath the baseboards, and any switching to worry about. So to have on board electrics, batteries, which, I mean, this technology is all catching up with us so quickly now, and it's there, really. And even for the very small scales. So I think that's probably the, you know, that will become more and more.
There's an interesting conversation going on at the moment. I think it's a perpetual conversation amongst modellers that when one standards improve, you get to a point where it seems like it's impossible to do anything because it will never live up to the standards that you want to achieve. Because you know that you're capable of achieving them, but they seem so far out of reach because every time you make a mistake, it seems like the end of the world. How would you get past that?
I think we all have to accept what we're capable of. As an example, I can look back at some of the models I made 25 years ago, and I look at them now and think, I don't think I'd attempt that today. At the time, it seemed, yes, I had time on my side then as well, but and obviously the interest and the inspiration to get on with it, and I thoroughly enjoyed making the models. And I really did, and I can think back to times when I was absolutely engrossed in these things and just couldn't put them down. And now I look at them and think, I'm not sure I want to put all that detail back in that now. Sure, maybe I'll just cut back a little bit. And I think we do what satisfies ourselves.
That's really interesting because it's almost like you're on the opposite side of that curve then, having sort of attained a level of detail that you now don't want to achieve because you're satisfied with not less detail, but maybe a more impressionistic approach.
Yes, I'm not saying I'm satisfied. I'm keen not to include the detail. It's just that I suppose there comes a time when you look ahead and think, do I really want to go through all this construction process? But having said that, once you get into these, it's making a start very often. And maybe it's because at the moment I haven't got anything particularly that I'm desperately keen to make a model of. At the time, I was desperately keen to build certain locomotives, certain bits of rolling stock. And, you know, I was going to do it, and that was it. And I was so keen, I was happily jumped into it all. Now, there isn't anything specifically that I want to do. Now, maybe if I got the inspiration to build something like that, it might be, you know, I might look at it differently. I won't say I'm not interested in putting the detail in. It's just that sometimes I just think, you know, how did I at the time get enough concentration and get my mind around that? You know, why didn't I throw the towel in? But I didn't.
I think what you say about making a start being the most important thing is very important to remember. A lot of people are paralysed by a fear of failure. What would your advice be to somebody who says, I'd like to do this, but I'm worried I'll mess it up?
Oh, I wouldn't. It's easy to say, isn't it? But I wouldn't worry. You just do the best you can. And if it doesn't work, don't be afraid to start afresh. Or if you're cutting a piece out and that piece doesn't come the right shape, don't be afraid to put it aside and cut it again. Don't think because I've cut it out and I've just spent 3 hours doing that carefully, you know, out of a piece of metal or whatever it is, and I've just shaped all this piece and now I've done it, it doesn't fit. Well, I'm going to have to stick it in anyway, whether it's a perfectionist sort of attitude or something, I don't know. But I think, you know, it's far better just to discard that bit. No, it didn't work. I'll come back to it tomorrow and do that bit again and try and make note of where I got it wrong and get it right this time. I think it gets quite dispiriting when you're building a model and it's not going right and you're still carrying on with it. Far better to stop, try and get what's not worked out right, and then pick it up and move on. And then it can be a very satisfying thing to work with.
So knowing where to cut off to avoid yourself becoming dispirited and frustrated with it, sort of banging your head against a brick wall trying to get something right, it might be better to step back, put it aside for a while, come back to it later.
Yes. I mean, this is easy to say because I'm probably the worst in the world for sort of, if something's not working very well at 10 o'clock at night, I'm going to like it to be there still to 2 in the morning trying to make it right. but because I don't want to let go until I've got it right. But yes, the sensible thing would be to put it down at 10 o'clock and come back tomorrow night and have another go.
I've definitely had that where I've kept making mistakes because I'm tired and I'd be much better off just having a sleep, coming back to it the next day.
Yeah.
But you keep battering away at it until it's just pile of parts.
Well, I totally agree with you. But that's the willpower and it's psychology comes into this, which I don't want to get started on that. way out of depth.
On a similar tone, how does a serious or professional modeller take an escape from modelling so that it doesn't become a chore?
I suppose change. I mean, I was a professional modeller for a time. I was very fortunate that I wasn't doing my work from home. So I was actually able to sort of make a journey to work and work on a different bench. And at that time, I could come home and I could model railways as a complete different subject matter, different workbench and a fresh approach.
And what were you modelling at work at the time?
Ships. So it was all nautical subjects.
The fact that you actually came home and carried on modelling in general was quite impressive, because did you ever feel a bit fatigued by it?
No. In fact, if anything, when I started doing the model ships, it was during the break I'd taken from model railways. And then I suppose I was about 10 years into a break from the hobby. And having started modelling again, despite the fact it was a different subject altogether, I suddenly started feeling familiar with the materials and everything and wanted to get back into doing something for myself. And it actually encouraged me to get back into model railways. And that's strange how it started.
Have you ever felt that it has become a bit of a chore and that you need a break from it?
Well, it's only a hobby now. So no. I still thoroughly enjoy it. And the exhibition side of it has opened it up so much more and made it even more enjoyable.
Why is that?
It's the people. It's the people you meet. Always among the exhibitors, there are always some that you will know, and there's a certain camaraderie and social side to it that is very enjoyable. And the visitors to exhibitions, just having conversations. And I mean, it is just so satisfying when you can have conversations with people, and you certainly get the impression that they're inspired by either what we've done or what I've done or what other people tell us. You know, well, we're seeing stuff in the exhibition generally, and it's really, you know, and we'll often talk about, you know, another layout that they've had time to have a look at, and it's really inspired them. And you just think, if they're inspired to go away and have a go at something, yeah, that would be really nice, you know. And they just hope that they get as much fun out of it as we do.
Some people have talked about exhibitions being great for the modelling because of the deadline focusing their attention on something, the deadline to exhibit. Was that the case with you?
No, I left deadlines at work. The model ships were great. It was if I had to do a job, I always said it was the best job I could have. You know, except in the fact I had to work for a living, it was a great job. But at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, that starts to get a little bit... the novelty wears off. No, for my own modelling, I gave myself ample time. I've always said I will not work to a deadline. So if I'm building, for instance, a layout, and I'm asked to exhibit it whilst I'm still building it, then I will not accept any dates at all until I know the end is in sight. I won't, with bare baseboards and a bit of track down, thinking, oh, I'm sure we can get something out of this. No, I won't take any dates or I won't take any commitments at that stage.
That's really interesting, because it kind of keeps it casual in that case.
Yes, yes.
When you are modelling, do you usually do it with complete silence, or the radio on, or television, or do you usually have an accompaniment to your modelling?
Not always. If anything, it'll be the radio. Radio 4, usually. Something chatty. Just a chat programme, and I can listen to that while I'm working. Television, complete no-no. Now, I can't concentrate at all with the television on, so it is purely radio. And I'm not a great one for having music while I'm working. That just seems to just distract me or irritate me, depending on the music.
I think some can make it feel a bit like a sweatshop when it gets faster and faster. How did things evolve from being just a modeller to becoming known as the modelling genius you are today?
Oh, gracious me. I don't recognise myself as that.
That's one to put you on the spot.
I model what I enjoy making, and I can't do any more. I mean, if it inspires somebody else, that's great. But I mean, all I'm starting with is something that I want to make a model of. And whether it's a tree or whether it's a farm gate or whether it's a locomotive. It's got to inspire me in the first place, and I've never thought of myself any differently. It's got to interest me anyway. It's got to inspire me to want to build the model. But I don't recognise myself in the question.
What are common mistakes to avoid when modelling, specifically scenery?
I think overcrowding a scene can be quite... you've got to be cautious of it. I'm not saying it's a common one to avoid, but it's one that I'm very aware of overcrowding a scene. Try and keep things simple to start with. You can always add a little bit more. You can always cut stuff out, quite honestly. And sometimes you just have to think, no, there's just too much in that. I've got to tear some of this out. But it's having that discipline to look at it and recognise that things are becoming too crowded sometimes. On the actual scenic side, I mean, going back to the static grass, I think one of the problems that I get asked about time and time again is, how do you get the grass to stand up? When I do it, it just seems to lay flat. And the answer there invariably is the use of too much glue and the glue being too wet. I tend to use very little glue and I tend to use it very, very sticky. And then the grass, I find, seems to stand up. Where very often I ask, when we're doing a demonstration, I ask people to sort of, you tell me how you're doing it. And when I start sort of showing what I do and I put a little bit of glue on, they say, oh, no, I'd put far more than that on. Then I start to wonder whether, that might be the problem. There's so many variables to a lot of this scenic work. But certainly with the static grass, that's been a challenge. It seems to work, and it seems to be sort of being very moderate with the glue on that one. That is a question I get asked time and time again. Yeah, it is. It's probably the most common question when I'm doing a scenic demonstration is, how do you get it to stand up? And it invariably comes down to either the amount of glue, and often there seems to be the perception that more glue is better, or dilute the glue and, thinner glue. They're quite surprised how thick and stodgy it is when I use it. And using the grass applicator, working from often the instructions that come with some of them, they suggest holding them quite high above and, maybe sort of 6 inches to a foot above the surface. And I would say, no, get right in as close as you can.
We've seen Aaron Key most recently from you. What are you working on next, or what you've got planned next?
I am starting another very small French layout. I've still got French stock and I've built a little bit more. And a very small, again, it's going to be a bit of a harbour scene. It's not quite a French version of Aaron Key. It'll have a different atmosphere to it. But that is the ongoing project, but it's very early days. So, I'm certainly not getting involved with any exhibition commitments. And it's still at my doodling stage at the moment. I've got one or two buildings which we've settled on, and because Maggie gets involved with those as well. She's very competent with model buildings and things. And I'm just starting to sort of get my head round the actual scene and visually how it's going to look. So it's early. And I've recently built another locomotive for it. So that's been, in fact, the last two locomotives I've built, I've changed my method slightly. Rather than cutting everything out by hand, I now tend to use the photo etch method and draw it on the computer, get the main components photo etched, basically produce myself a kit of parts. That's the last two locomotives have both been done that way. They work very well, actually. I mean, the accuracy is just so much easier to draw it accurately on the computer.
You're almost cutting out a stage, aren't you?
You're cutting out
the human error.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, my training, going right back to my apprenticeship, was as a draftsman anyway. So I'm quite familiar with drawing, although that used to be longhand. That wasn't on a computer. Drawing has always interested me. And I suppose I was very fortunate in going through an engineering apprenticeship. I also got involved with fabrication. So apart from sort of drawing up, for instance, how you're going to make a box, I had to make a box and I had to fold it and make it and weld it, or in the modelling sense, solder it. So a lot of it was training for what became very useful stuff in the modelling side.
Absolutely. And will this layout, so it's almost a spiritual successor to both Pemple and Aaron Key. Will there be any unique elements that we haven't seen from you before?
Yes, there will be one. It's a turntable. And really, it was a challenge. I've never made a turntable before. And I just wanted to make a turntable. So before I even started work on the layout, I made myself a model of a turntable. And I couldn't even start thinking about building the layout until I got the turntable to work.
It often becomes the centrepiece as well, the turntable, because it's one of those things that the public are really interested in watching work.
I hope so, because it's not going to be very big, and it's going to be a pretty boring layout without it.
Speaking about previous work, what do you do with your old models? Do you keep them, or do you tend to move them on?
That's always a difficult one. As far as layouts are concerned, I've been very fortunate that two have gone to new homes. Penpool has got a new home at the moment, although it's in storage. Hopefully one day we'll see that again. What do you do with old layouts? Yes. Rolling stock. I have never parted with rolling stock. I just find I can't part with it. So I've got various bits of rolling stock which I never use, will never use, but I'm very reluctant to part with. Maybe some I will in the end, because it's just taking up space and some hasn't seen the light of day for 20 years. But
I can understand the emotional attachment to it, the sentimental want to keep it.
Mm.
It's something that, we wouldn't be modelling railways if there wasn't rolling stock. So it's often quite a centrepiece, and you do put a lot of yourself into it. And making something work, I think, there's something different about making something that works.
Yes.
That moves.
I was very satisfied with, the first bits of rolling stock I built from scratch, if you like, rather than from a kit, were locomotives that were sort of allocated to our local loco sheds when I lived in Sussex. So we're talking steam locos, London, Brighton, South Coast Railway. I've got three scratch-built locomotives, which I really was enthused and inspired to build, simply because I'd seen the actual engines. They were the ones that were allocated literally a mile away from where I lived, and I saw them on a regular basis. So I particularly wanted to model those. So those, I would never part with those. They've got a very personal attachment. And the French stuff also, I think just the amount of research and work that went into it. And besides which, who would ever be interested in buying 1-50 French stuff anyway? So I'm probably stuck with it.
What have you seen that's generally happened to layouts when they finish their tour of exhibitions?
It's a very difficult one, this, because very often they've got a sentimental attachment to their builders anyway. So builders are very reluctant to get rid of them, sell them on, scrap them even, which, has to happen sometimes. But it's you can imagine the amount of work going into building a layout. I certainly wouldn't like to, even think of dismantling, let alone taking an axe to one. Sometimes they find new homes, new buyers will be interested in taking them on. If it's built to a sort of a popular scale, then this is, and somebody else might be able to run their stock on it. So that is often. Sometimes they re-emerge as exhibition layouts under a different name. I know a couple that has happened to. Sometimes they get sold on, and I was fortunate that with Ditchling Green, I sold that, and since then it's turned up on eBay and it's now residing in France somewhere, apparently. I haven't heard anything of it for the last 5-6 years, but that was the last I heard.
For you, when you moved a layout on, was there a part of you that did want to see it again or feared seeing it again? Because I think that it's a bit like selling your old car, and when you see it again and someone hasn't taken care of it, it makes you feel sad. Is there a bit of you can take care of it, but I don't want to see it?
Yes, there are very mixed emotions. By the time I'm sort of ready to sort of part with a layout, I'm usually quite deeply involved with the next one or something else. So my interest in the inspiration, if you like, is moving on. And there comes a point where you have to make space. Certainly in my case, I haven't got unlimited space. But it's nice to think they're going to a good home. I was very comforted to see some photographs of Ditchling Green many years after I'd parted company with it, to see that, in fact, I couldn't see any difference. And that was very heartening. So whoever's got it is looking after it and respecting it as it was. If somebody had showed me photographs of the baseboards with all the track ripped up, I might have had different feelings. But having said that, we're talking 20 years ago, so would it really worry me that much now. But no, it's all, you know, a lot of work goes into building models. I suppose while I was doing it professionally, it helped me to get over this a little bit, because we were spending many hours, only a matter of weeks in time, because it was quite a group of us doing it, working together as a team. But when you've spent sort of, you know, 300, 400, 500, 600 hours building a model, and literally as you're putting the final details on it, it's being cased up and it's going out the door, you're not getting any time to appreciate it as a finished model, or you've just got your memories of how pleasurable it was, or what a so-and-so, a certain part of it was to get right, you know. So, yeah, time moves on, and so do the models sometimes. So
I've certainly seen that with people who build sets and props for films, is that after a certain amount of time, they form an emotional detachment from it all. Because I think part of it is that they know they can always build another one. You know, if they really want it again, they can just make it again.
Yes, I think that's true. And as I say, you know, my thoughts and interests are usually moving on to something else. And hopefully we can build an improvement on what you did before. You know, there's everything has its shortcomings. You can look at every layout I've built. I can sort of think, oh, I wouldn't do it that way again. I wish I'd just done something slightly different there. And I hate going back over work, so I've never altered them, never put anything right that I didn't think was quite right.
Why is that? Was that a decision that you made, or something you're not really interested in doing?
I've really got no interest. I want to get it right in the first place, but I got no interest in going back over it.
So is your attitude more, you know, if I do it again in a different setting, then I'll make an improvement on it then?
Oh, yes. Make a complete fresh model, maybe, and try and get it right. But to actually go back and alter something, at the time of making it, I'll try and correct it as I'm working. But once it's finished, and the other silly thing is that you make a model and some things don't work out quite. I mean, nothing goes right all the time. And very often you're very aware of things, shortcomings when you're building these things. And then within a week or two, you've moved on to some other part of it and you've forgotten all about what the shortcomings were. And they don't, you can't, you look at the models now and think, well, I can't see what was all the fuss about. I'm sure I'm not alone in that.
I think I've seen it from both ends, where I know there's mistakes with something, but I just think, I'll just do it on the next one. You know, I'll fix it the next time around. And on the other end of the scale, I've been looking at something that I've finished and then I can't take it anymore, and I just rip it to pieces again and start again. Yeah, I often feel better for having done it. Mm. But normally I would put it to one side and just put it out of my mind. But if something's really niggling me, I have to take it apart again.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean. And that's included literally breaking models apart with my hand to try and get the bonds to break. But yeah, brutal. It was quite late at night as well. Penpool and Aaron Key were both designed from the outset to be exhibition-only layouts. But what's your view on, or what's been your experience of home versus exhibition layouts?
The first layout I built when I sort of came back into the hobby, and previous ones, because when I lived with my parents back in the very sort of early days of my modelling, it was a garden shed, and the layout I was building then was built into a garden shed. So that was fairly permanent. And when I came back into the hobby after about a 15-year break, the little narrow gauge layout I built was intended for home use only. I never had any thoughts. I didn't know anybody on the exhibition circuit. I never thought it would have any interest. I didn't know I'd have any interest in doing that. But after a couple of months of, after it was finished, I've discovered that, or I realised that it wasn't being used. Stock was just being left on it. It's collecting dust. And then as it happened, I got invited to one local show. Very low key, but it was good fun. We thoroughly enjoyed the day. And while we were there, we got invited to another one. So, I mean, we were very all prepared for all this. I mean, presentation was non-existent. I lashed up a couple of angle poise lamps to give some illumination, which must have looked dreadful when I think back on it. But anyway, it did, I say, the first show and then a second. And then from that, it got invited to a third. And so it went on. And the next thing, we sort of realised that this was escalating into sort of quite a few exhibitions. So it got revamped a little bit with a bit more presentation to sort of try and bring it up to the standard of all the other. I mean, we were seeing other layouts which were far more better prepared than we were. It was a steep learning curve. And then Ditchling Green was built primarily, well, solely for exhibitions, because I had no space to put that one up at home. So then we had to take that into account right from day one. Make it strong, make it protected when it was boxed up. It had to be transported in a trailer, which is nerve-wracking enough as it is. But it served its purpose as an exhibition layout. It was made so it could be set up fairly easily and quickly. It was far too heavy. I made it strong, but it was very heavy. You soon realise when you start carrying these things any distance from the car park or upstairs and things. By the time we got to Penpool, everything was starting to sort of become designed for lightweight and protection right from the outset. And the same with Arran Quay, whereas Penpool had to be transported in a van because of its size. Arran Quay is back to the back of the car and designed specifically for that. To the point that when we went to change cars, I took a tape measure with me.
And how do you view, because a lot of people have home layouts so that they can effectively play with their trains at home. But I suppose if you're doing a lot of exhibitions, that's your time that you actually get to play with the layout and experience it in its working form. Is that something you're happy with, or do you miss having something at home to enjoy?
No, I don't think I'd ever use a layout at home. I've set them up when I first build them, and I enjoy taking photographs of them. But once that's done, I don't think there's any inclination to want to set it up at home. We're very fortunate. We've been invited to a number of exhibitions, and we've got quite a number still booked to do. So, no, I get all my interest out of operating at exhibitions, and there we've got the added bonus of an audience we can chat with and pass the time with, you know, discussions about modelling generally. So it becomes that we're sort of a more sociable way of operating the layout rather than just in isolation at home. And I don't really miss not being able to just shunt a few wagons at home. No.
So I'm really looking forward to seeing the next layout, the French port.
Yes, I hopefully we will get there with it one day when I've got my head round the sort of design, the doodles stop. I haven't built baseboards yet, so it's got a little way to go. Well, I hope you enjoy it when you see it.
No deadlines.
No deadlines, as I said. So we're talking quite a few years off, and I'm very fortunate that we've got a little bit of time with Arran Quay in the meantime. But yes, it's something to look forward to and something to sort of keep the grey matter going. I think it's a hobby that keeps us thinking, keeps us having to sort of get round problems. I thoroughly enjoy it and I hope to carry on doing so.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It's been great to have you.
You're most welcome.
And I hope to speak to you again soon.
All right. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Gordon for giving up his time to come on the podcast. I'm absolutely indebted to you. As always, if you'd like to hear more Railway Mania, check us out at railwaymania.net, where you can find links to all the previous podcasts. If you've been listening to the audio version of this and you fancy a bit more, remember to look at the YouTube Railway Mania, and you'll find a deluxe version with lots of images and video to accompany it. Don't forget to subscribe for more Railway Mania in the future. I hope to release more video content over the next few months. I wouldn't be here without you, the audience, and I'm forever grateful to you. Thanks very much. Bye.